Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 31st of October, these are our main stories. As Britain prepares for a general election, Twitter announces it will no longer carry political adverts anywhere in the world. Survivors of London's devastating Grenfell Tower blaze call for senior fire brigade staff to be sacked. And Chile says it can't host two major meetings of world leaders because of domestic unrest. Also in this podcast,
I've come to the conclusion that this is a very slow environmental genocide.
The Archbishop of York says he's shocked by environmental damage in Nigeria. And how long does it take you to recognise a piece of music? Researchers say a tenth of 1 second is normal. Social media has become a crucial tool for those looking to win elections and influence them. And as the popularity of these platforms has grown, so too has the scrutiny of their governance and role in spreading so-called fake news. Now, Twitter has announced that it will ban all political advertising worldwide. I asked our technology correspondent, Rory Kethlen-Jones, just how significant this announcement is.
This is all announced in a kind of long series of tweets, appropriately, by Jack Dorsey, Twitter's founder. And he's effectively saying that political messages should be earned, not bought. In other words, you as a political party can go on Twitter and tweet anywhere you like. And if you are good enough and if you people listen to you, then you can spread it for free. But buying it is something he doesn't like. And he goes through a whole series of reasons why he's worried about internet advertising in general. He says it's incredibly powerful, but the power brings significant risks to politics, where it can be used to influence votes to affect the lives of millions. He talks about machine learning-based optimization of messaging. That's using AI, artificial techniques, to target people, micro-targeting, unchecked misleading information, deep fakes, that sort of fake videos, which are becoming more common. And he's worried about all of these techniques and say this is a huge challenge for society, really.
This is being seen as a not so subtle dig at Facebook. Is it just a PR move?
Yeah, in the middle of this, there is a tweet which says, for instance, it's not credible for us to say we're working hard to stop people from gaming our systems to spread misleading info. But if someone pays us for a political ad, well, they can say whatever they want. Now, that will be seen as a swipe at Facebook, which has got this quite controversial policy of allowing political ads with misinformation and not checking them in any way. It will be seen as part of that battle. It's not a difficult thing for him to do in some ways, because, you know, I'm sure they make very little money out of political advertising, and it may be more trouble than it's worth. And there's also been a lot of pressure on Twitter over, for instance, Donald Trump's use of the platform. People are asking whether political leaders are allowed to spread misinformation when the general public is not.
Twitter's tiny compared to Facebook.
Twitter is small, but it is. There's a lot of focus on it during elections, and I'm sure there will be during the UK's forthcoming general election. It is used by a lot of politicians to get their message across. That will still happen. They'll just have to do it for free without the kind of leg up of a paid-for ad.
Rory Kethlen-Jones. Survivors of London's devastating Grenfell Tower blaze, which killed 72 people in June 2017, are calling for senior fire brigade staff to be sacked and prosecuted. The calls come after a report on the disaster by a retired judge, Sir Martin Moore Bick, who found that many lives could have been saved if the building was evacuated sooner. The BBC's Home Affairs correspondent, Dominic Cassiani, has been studying the report.
The chairman, Sir Martin Moore Bick, who is a retired senior judge here in the UK, says two things. He says that he's not blaming individual firefighters who risk their lives time and again to go into the building amid the inferno to try and get residents out. But he is questioning what on earth was going on within London Fire Brigade, the capital's firefighting service, because it appeared not to have learned lessons from the past. In particular, a very important fire about 10 years ago in London in a similar block, which raised serious questions about the ability of the capital's fire service to combat such a fire. He also raises questions about the nature of the building's refurbishment. This was a social housing block in West London. It undergone a relatively expensive refurbishment with the adding of cladding and insulation to the front of the building to deal with British winters. But that cladding, in effect, in the chairman's view, promoted the fire, because while the individual flats themselves were largely fire safe, the fire couldn't spread initially from one apartment to the next. The fire could escape through the windows and set fire to the highly flammable substances which had been applied to the front of the building as cladding. And that, in essence, led to the inferno. And I'll just give an example of how these different factors came together to cause such an enormous tragedy. The London Fire Brigade, like many fire services around the world, has what's called a stay-put policy in tall buildings. And what that means is if a fire breaks out on a particular floor, residents or office workers are told to stay put in other parts of the building while the fire is put out on that individual floor. In this particular case, that strategy was followed. But it appears, says the chairman, that London Fire Brigade simply didn't conceive of a moment until it was far too late in the fire to actually reverse and revoke that policy and tell people to get out. So they were repeatedly telling people to stay in their apartments, saying help is on its way, when in actual fact the fire was running out of control and nobody really had any means at all to stop it.
Dominic Cassiani. Finding celebrity memorabilia online for sale isn't so unusual, especially if it's something like a hat, a guitar pick or a game-worn jersey. But what if it's used medical waste, like an IV drip from a trip to the hospital, and the people who put it up for sale were hospital staff? It's a bizarre story that's led to 11 people being suspended from a hospital in China. The BBC's Kerry Allen explains.
11 members of staff at a hospital in eastern China have been suspended for 12 months, and this is because they tried to sell off or show pictures of the medical waste of a Singaporean singer called JJ Lin, who'd been staying in the hospital after being treated for a cold. So what happens is this singer, he'd had this short-term illness and he'd gone for treatment. And after he'd left the hospital, and he's a big star in China, he's got more than 52 million followers on Sina Weibo, which is the big social media platform in China. The members of staff at the hospital decided they were going to take pictures of his IV drip, his needles, and they'd even filmed each other laying on the bed that he'd been staying in. So these appeared on a platform called WeChat and they were circulating, and somebody raised the alarm and said this is really concerning for patient privacy. The hospital decided to do an investigation. It's now suspended these members of staff. And they've seen things like this before and they're really quite disgusted by it. They're saying that medical waste should be disposed of properly. There was a Hong Kong singer called Karen Mok who'd stayed in a hotel in China, and after she'd vacated the hotel, rather than cleaning her room, the hotel managers decided that they were going to auction off her room to people who might want to stay, see her used towels and her sheets. So yeah, China's seen things like this before and people are not sympathetic in the slightest, but very, very concerned about this level of chasing celebrities.
Kerry Allen. Plenty of musicians have expressed their support for environmental issues in the past, but the music business, with its merchandise and jet setting, has hardly got a model carbon footprint. That's led some musicians and industry figures in the UK to form Music Declares Emergency to press for action in their sector against global warming. Bands from Radiohead and The Pretenders to Hot Chip and the 1975 have signed up. Keith Adams went to their very first event in London.
Musicians and people working in the music industry have made it through heavy rain to come to this church in West London. They're here to respond to the climate crisis. At this, the first event of Music Declares Emergency. My God. But what can actually be done? Karen Simmons works on the sustainability policy for the major label Universal Music UK. She told me what the label had achieved so far.
Universal has recently moved to a fantastic new building. It's got a number of sustainable features. It's combined heat and power. The location of it, it really encourages people to travel to work either by public transport. We've got 200 bike racks beneath the building. We now don't even have a car parking space. Not that Universal want to brag about what they're doing, but I think now is the time really we need to start sharing and normalising good behaviour and encouraging our business partners to behave and create a virtuous circle in all that we do.
The carbon cost of the music industry wouldn't be there if it ceased to exist. What about the sort of charges of hypocrisy that are kind of inevitable? What do you say to that?
I think my answer would be, well, we could all not exist and therefore our carbon footprint would disappear. That isn't really a reality, and I think it's important to recognise the richness that music brings to people's lives and the fact that it can inspire change. We've seen it inspire change across the ages, and now's the time to go and do that again.
One of Music Declare's Emergency's founders is Faye Milton, the drummer with the band Savages. She admits that one of the key challenges the industry faces is the amount of flights made by touring musicians. Like many industries grappling with climate change, the music industry has to balance profit against its carbon footprint. But the message from Music Declare's Emergency seems to be that it can and must do more.
Keith Adams. We've already been talking about the latest Brexit extension, but how did we get to this point? And what's the best way of trying to explain what's going on with Britain's exit from the European Union? Well, take the BBC's most downloaded podcast, the Global News podcast, and mash it up with a one-off special from the brilliant Brexit cast.
Hello, this is Jackie Leonard, and I'm here to say that once you've finished listening to this edition of the Global News podcast, you might want to check out the special episode we recorded with the team from the BBC's Brexit cast. If you have questions about Brexit, you might just find some answers, and you will find them elsewhere in our feed. Now, though, back to today.
And you can just look for the Global News Brexit cast a little further down the Global News podcast feed. For the Chilean government, the final months of 2019 were meant to be a time of pomp and prestige, with the South American country due to host two major meetings of world leaders. But now, amid huge anti-government protests, President Sebastián Piñera has cancelled November's Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit and December's United Nations Conference on Climate Change. President Piñera called the decision a difficult and painful one.
Sentimos y lamentamos profundamente los problemas.
We deeply regret the problems and the inconvenience that this decision will have on APEC, as well as for the UN conference. As president for all Chileans, I have to always put the problems and the interests of Chileans, their necessities and their hopes first.
Well, to find out more about these protests, I spoke to our South America correspondent, Katie Watson.
Well, these protests were sparked by an increase in metro fares earlier this month. That was just the spark. They escalated to a much bigger degree. People here, they're angry about the lack of progress in the country, the massive inequalities in the country, because Chile is one of the most, you know, wealthy countries in the region, but inequality is one of the biggest problems. And so people, you know, said enough was enough, that they weren't going to stand for it anymore. They wanted a substantive change, really, to the way politics was done. So President Piñera at first, you know, talked about the fact that he was facing this enemy on the streets, which got people very angry. He then made some concessions, trying to increase the minimum wage and pensions. That wasn't enough. He tried to shake up the cabinet. That still wasn't enough. So it's come to the point where people are still on the streets wanting some change. And he's said he's cancelling both APEC and the climate change summit.
What will these cancellations mean for the president's image and for Chile's image in the wider world?
Well, that's right, because these two events, as you said, were putting Chile on the map. People were seeing this country, which has done, you know, incredibly well in the last decade or so. But what this means, well, I mean, the president has to deal with what's going on at home. And in fact, he said in his statement that, you know, just like a father who has problems with the family, it's the family that comes first. You know, a president needs to look after his people, and that comes before anything else. But, you know, they may well have been kind of emotive words, but really he's struggling to be able to deal with these protests and trying to contain them or trying to end them and coming up with a solution to try and move the country forward. So at the moment, he's very focused on, that's his aim, is to be very focused on what's going on at home. But as of now, there doesn't seem to be any agreement between the government and people.
Katie Watson. Staying in South America, a Holocaust museum in Buenos Aires, Argentina, has reportedly put an exhibition of so-called Nazi treasures on hold after experts cast doubt on the authenticity of the collection. Peter Goffin told me more.
There were media reports that called this Hitler's silver treasure, which I think is probably overselling it a bit. But basically, it's 80 pieces that were discovered at the home of an antiques dealer in Buenos Aires in 2017. The haul includes a bust of Adolf Hitler, some medical-looking tools, and everyday objects, even a piggy bank, all covered in swastikas. Now, you might be asking why a hoard of Nazi relics would even be in Argentina, but there's actually strong historical basis for this. Hundreds of Nazis fled to South America after World War II, and the government of Argentina actually welcomed them at the time. We know that Adolf Eichmann, who's been called the architect of the Holocaust, and Josef Mengele, who performed medical experiments at concentration camps, both lived in Buenos Aires, is still a deeply shameful part of Argentina's history. And for the Holocaust Museum, which is said to be the only one of its kind in Latin America, these so-called treasures looked like a link to that period of their history.
Yeah, a bizarre collection of treasures, even a Ouija board with a swastika. But it turns out these objects may not be what they seemed.
Right. Now, way back in early 2018, the German police sent experts over to help investigators in Argentina try to authenticate these objects. They looked at 72 items, and they decided that at least 62 of them were outright forgeries, and not necessarily even very good forgeries. They said whoever inscribed some of the items obviously didn't speak German. Some of the Nazi iconography was simply wrong. There were plaques and trophies in the collection from events that never actually took place. Now, months after experts turned in their report, the Holocaust Museum announced its big exhibition of these items. And German media has reported that at one point the museum was even claiming the experts had actually said the items were authentic. But this week, according to the Times of London, the museum has finally put its show on hold. It said it won't display any artifacts that hadn't been authenticated. And one official said the museum's aim is to educate the public, not simply showcase Nazi memorabilia.
Peter Goffin. A slow environmental genocide. That's how the senior Church of England cleric, the Archbishop of York, Dr. John Sentamu, has described what's happening in Nigeria's Bayelsa state. He said oil companies needed to end a culture of double standards in Nigeria. Comments he made to the BBC while working for a commission investigating oil spills in the Niger Delta. The BBC's Myeni Jones reports from the Delta.
I'm on a boat headed to some of the waterfront communities that have been affected by oil spills in the state of Bayelsa in the Niger Delta. One of the things that's made it difficult for authorities to investigate this in the past is how remote many of these communities are. But that's precisely why they're in need of assistance, because many of them rely on fishing for their survival.
The waterways of Bayelsa in southern Nigeria were once a thriving ecosystem, but they've been devastated by decades of oil spills.
I'm at a spill site in Oyeregbene in Bayelsa, and they say that the initial spill happened in 2014 and that since then spills keep on recurring in this area, and it's really evident in the vegetation. Everywhere is completely blackened, only the skeletons of trees left, no animal life whatsoever, just black earth tarnishing everywhere.
Local residents are adamant these spills are behind the death of natural life in the region.
It's the oil. Even if you manage to catch a fish, it's not fit to eat. There are a few that are okay, and that's what we eat. But on others, their heads are the only things that are left. They are so slim. They have no flesh. So it's hard for us to feed ourselves.
I just want to say, first of all, thank you for hosting us in this, your community.
According to the Bayelsa State Oil and Environmental Commission, chaired by the Archbishop of York, oil companies are ultimately responsible for the environmental damage here. Dr. Johnson Tamu says they want to set up guidelines for oil extraction that will protect local communities.
You know, people talk about environmental degradation. I think that's too weak a phrase. For me, really, as I've looked at the environment and as I've looked at people's lives, I've come to the conclusion that this is a very slow environmental genocide, really, in the end.
For Dr. Santamu, the environmental damage here is far from a local issue.
I may have come from Uganda, I may now be living in the United Kingdom, but we live in a global village. These are my neighbours. I'm absolutely concerned about their well-being. And when you see in the poverty, a country that produces so much oil, and you look at the conditions in which they're living, it's just shocking.
Oil spills have been happening in the Niger Delta for decades. With the attention of the international community very much elsewhere, it's unclear who will enforce the Commission's new guidelines. But if nothing changes, the prospects for future generations here are unlikely to improve.
Maini Jones. Now, how long on average do you think it takes you to recognise a piece of music? A few seconds, maybe. Well, a new study has found some people can do this in just a tenth of 1 second. Richard Hamilton reports.
Many people take about this long to recognise a familiar piece of music, but for some of us, it takes about this long. That was about 300 milliseconds, or the time it takes a human eye to blink. And for some of us, it's even less, only 100 milliseconds. The research was carried out by scientists from the University College London Ear Institute, who wanted to find out just how quickly the brain responds to music. They knew it was fast, but were surprised by just how fast. To do this, the scientists measured pupil dilation in the eyes and electrical activity in the brain. Ulrich Pomper, who was part of the team, explains how they carried out the test.
We asked our subjects to provide a number of songs that they're very familiar with and also emotionally sort of attached to. And then we found songs that were sonically very similar, but that our subjects did not know. And then we chopped all the music up into very small snippets of under a second, so 750 milliseconds. And we randomized all of the snippets and played them back in random order to our subjects. The subjects did do nothing but listen passively. And then afterwards, we were looking at the brain responses and we were able to differentiate between which snippet was one that participants knew and were familiar with and which ones they were unfamiliar with.
Although a tenth of a second is probably less than the time it takes to hear a full note, Ulrich Pomper says we tend to recognise the timbre of the music using an ancient part of the brain before the rational part of the brain kicks in to analyse the lyrics and so on. He says understanding how the brain recognises familiar tunes is useful for various music-based therapies, for example, treating patients with dementia. For them, music is still deeply embedded in their memories, despite the failure of other aspects of their memory system.
Richard Hamilton. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.